From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you think your sex life isn't what it should be, cheer up. The real problem may be your expectations are unrealistic. On today's Fresh Air, the true story about sex in America, we talk with sociologist John Gagnon, one of the authors of a new study on the sex lives of Americans. The study found that Americans aren't having sex as often or with as many partners as the movies, magazines, and TV lead us to believe. And NYPD Blue makes its season premiere tonight. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says Iraqi troops near the Kuwaiti border may be moving. General John Shalikashvili says it's still not clear where those troops are going.
There's fairly broad movement for most of those units that had been brought down south. However, having said that, there's still an indication that considerable units still remaining, that we do not have any indication as to where the units that are preparing to move will be moving to.
Shalikashvili says the Pentagon does have indications Iraq has eased its state of military alert. He also says the United States will continue to beef up its forces in the Persian Gulf region. The Colorado Supreme Court has declared the state's anti-gay rights measure unconstitutional. The judges say it bars homosexuals from having an effective voice in government affairs. The court ruled 6-1 the measure denies homosexuals equal protection under the Constitution. The measure had been approved by Colorado voters in 1992. It prohibited state and local governments from passing laws protecting homosexuals from discrimination. It never took effect after a lower court blocked it, and subsequent rulings have all gone against it. NASA has wrapped up an 11-day shuttle mission to study global environmental change. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
While the rains fell on central Florida, Space Shuttle Endeavour made a perfect landing in the dry California desert today. Low clouds and threatening showers in Florida forced NASA to send the shuttle to Edwards Air Force Base. The poor weather conditions at the Cape will mean an additional $1 million tacked onto this mission. That's the cost of flying the shuttle back to the Kennedy Space Center. That's of little concern right now with NASA scientists who are still focusing on the success of this mission. The crew worked around the clock photographing the Earth below with radar that will eventually be processed into a three-dimensional map. The data will be compared with similar images taken last spring. Scientists will be looking for environmental change that is the result of either man or nature. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
PLO leader Yasser Arafat says Palestinians renounce violence against Israelis. Arafat has condemned a weekend shooting attack in Jerusalem. Two Islamic extremists killed two Israelis and wounded 13 others. Arafat is calling for an end to bloody actions that endanger the peace process. A U.S. Embassy spokesman in Haiti says ex-junta leaders Raul Cedras and Philippe Biambi will go into exile. Panama has reportedly been asked to accept both men. A Panamanian official says his government has been approached by the United States about granting the men asylum. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 50 points at 3,871. The Nasdaq is up 8 at 765. This is NPR. A Spokane, Washington hospital says an angry former employee may have made up a fake diet as a practical joke against the institution. The Sacred Heart Medical Center says a phony diet plan has circulated all over the world under its name for 10 years. A spokeswoman says the hospital answers hundreds of calls and letters about the diet every month. The eating plan promises the dieter will lose 10 to 17 pounds in 7 days by consuming food in strange combinations. For example, on day one, the dieter can have all the skim milk and bananas desired, but on day three, the eater can have unlimited fruits and vegetables, but no potatoes. Leaders of Japan's Liberal Democratic Party are denying a New York Times report the party received millions of dollars from the CIA during the 1950s and 60s. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The Times reported the CIA had funneled cash to the conservative LDP, which governed for a generation after the war, to make Japan a bulwark against communism and to subvert the Japanese left. Although the revelations date back to the middle of the Cold War 25 years ago, they are still potent enough to potentially paralyze the ruling coalition's fragile government. And the LDP, the largest member in that coalition, was quick to react. "It's an excessive nuisance," said the party's secretary general. The LDP president, Foreign Minister Rotaro Kono, denied the report and said the party has notified the newspaper, quote, that there has never been such a fact. The facts detailed by The Times were compiled from a range of interviews with former diplomats and intelligence officers, as well as newly declassified documents. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Three economists have been jointly awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics. The Swedish Academy is honoring Jean Hasrani, now at the University of California at Berkeley, American John Nash, a researcher at Princeton University, and Richard Stelton of the University of Bonn. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sex. TV and movies may lead you to believe that our society is totally promiscuous, but a new study about sex in America has found that that perception bears virtually no relationship to the truth. The authors say the commonly held belief that everyone else is having a more active and exciting sex life than you are is creating false expectations that often interfere with relationships, not to mention self-esteem. My guest John Gagnon is one of four principal researchers behind a new survey that reports on how often we have sex, with whom, how satisfying it is, and which diseases we're catching. The results are published in the new book, Sex in America. Now, some of our listeners may be uncomfortable listening to a frank discussion about sex, so use your judgment. This new survey was originally going to be funded by the federal government. I asked Gagnon what happened.
Well, we began the research in about 1987 based on a government contract which was let out to do a pretest, essentially to find out whether such a study could be done. Over the next year and a half, we in fact worked on that study. We designed the interview schedule. And because it was a study for the government, it meant that for peculiarly arcane reasons that the questionnaire itself had to be reviewed by the Office of Management and Budget. When the questionnaire got to the Office of Management and Budget, it was then reviewed by the new Bush administration, who then alerted or were alerted by the right that basically this was a bad idea. And so for the next 2 years, we engaged in sort of a long struggle over whether or not the study could be done. And I think we were largely talked to death. I think everybody knew the study wasn't going to be done except us. And by and large, it went on and on and on. Version after version of the questionnaire would be written and revised and returned, eliminating all kinds of sections of the study until finally it was nearly a purely an AIDS study. Even in that narrow guise, there was no way we could get the study through the government. And finally, Jesse Helms introduced an amendment in the Senate to an appropriations bill, which said, "Thou shalt not fund a study of adult sexual behavior, and thou shalt not fund a study of teenage sexual behavior." And that was the end of it.
How did you manage to do the study even though the government pulled out?
Well, we had gotten a grant from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do a national survey of sexual attitudes at the same time. And we then said to ourselves, why don't we take a chance? Why don't we see if we can get other foundation support to turn this into the study we wanted to do when we began?
What did you want to learn from the study about the sex lives of Americans?
Well, I think that, and I guess we wanted to learn everything. that we didn't know anything. I mean, I've been doing sex research for about 30 years and joined the Kinsey Institute staff in the late 1950s. And always had felt a kind of uneasiness about both the Kinsey data and all the other studies that came after it in terms of the representation of sexual life of Americans.
Why did you distrust the results?
I think it was mostly the sampling question. The ways in which people got the people they talked to seemed to me sufficiently defective that basically they were talking to highly self-selected populations, not bad people, but simply people who weren't representative. And I could see out there in the society people who weren't talking to us and weren't talking to other sex researchers.
Let's start with the big picture. I think the big picture of your study basically says we're not a nation of swingers.
Well, it's I think that we don't have very many partners, we mm-hmm. don't do it very often, and we don't do it very exotically. And I think that's the kind of core message of the general portrait which we see of Americans.
Now, you asked the question, you know, who are our partners? How do people find people? And your conclusion is most people choose a partner who is more or less just like them.
Well, I've been trying to think of a way of phrasing that. And I think the society is sort of formed of islands of interaction. That is, it's not that we're sort of a country where everybody is sort of evenly distributed, but in fact, we're sort of a society of clumps of people. When we looked at our data, for instance, about are you alike ethnically or racially to the person, your sexual partners, 90% of all sexual partners in the United States match on race. About 85% plus match on college, on education, that is, whether someone's been to grade school, high school, or college, or graduate school. About 70% of the people match on religion if you divide it up by Catholic, Protestant, etc. So that there are islands of how people match up with each other. And that's the way you meet that nice person across the crowded room.
Well, interpret this for us. What's the significance?
Well, across a crowded, it's not that people don't fall in love. It's that they fall in love with people who are like them. That the society is so designed socially. And you find who you marry or who you go out with through networks of friends. You use your friends to give you bona fides about the people you meet. That's on one side. That's getting somebody. As you bring people closer and closer to your intimate relationships, then you have a whole series of other people who are sort of critics of who your choice is. They want you to bring someone who's socially like them into the family. So that you have a whole series of screens, which are much more than your own screens or preferences.
You've asked a lot of questions in the survey about how many partners people have. And one of your findings is that most American marriages are monogamous. People are pretty faithful within marriage. Do you have any statistics off the top of your head on that?
Well, in a lifetime, about men have a median, meaning 50% have more and 50% have less, mm-hmm. of six partners. And women have a median of about two. Now, that shows you how skewed toward zero it is, toward one and zero. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't people out there having a lot more partners. It's just that they don't represent the majority of Americans. Indeed, about 20% of Americans, if you take both men and women, have 11 or more partners in a lifetime. So it's not that nobody's having lots of partners, but it really suggests how far, as statisticians say, skewed to the left, toward the zero, these numbers really are. It seems to me that what you have is that people tend to accumulate partners when they are not in couples, when they're searching. And when they found a partner, they then move into a relationship which is largely monogamous for a long period of time until the relationship goes sour. And it's not that people are having lots of multiple partners and lots of overlaps. It's that Americans are really committed, I think, both for reasons of their own values and for reasons of the structure of the society, to monogamy until a relationship goes bad. And then I think Americans are pretty ready to leave those relationships that go bad and find a new one.
Now, do you look at the numbers of sex partners single people had, people who are single for long periods of time, and does that seem to be on the way up or the way down?
Well, in general, single people have more partners, but do it less times. And, of course, that ought to make sense to us. Because
explain that to me.
Well, if you're looking for a partner, mm-hmm. then basically what happens is, and then you find someone, and then you have intercourse, and then you break up. Basically what happens is that you have intercourse some number of times. You may have a couple of more partners, but compared to married people who have immediate access to sexual partners, so that you get this kind of tension between partners and frequency. And that then affects the problem of pleasure. that is, people who are used to each other sexually. A New York journalist said, gave me the distinction. He said, well, he said, it sounds to me like married people are interested in doing it, and single people are interested in getting it done. That is, that the focus in the married couple is the general framework of mutually pleasing each other. The single people is, are we going to get it done? Let's get it done, without much focus on the pleasure.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of people assume that the people who are having the most sex are the singles out there who were having interesting and varied sexual lives. What you found is kind of the opposite, that it's the married people who are having the most frequent sex and also the most fulfilling sex.
I think that's correct.
I should say coupled people, people living with
right
sexual partners, yeah, married or unmarried.
The cohabitation has the same, as many of the same effects as marriage. So that being in a couple is the crucial issue.
So were you surprised at this finding, or did you expect it?
I guess I wasn't surprised at one level, because I thought this is where the numbers were going to come in. On the other hand, as someone who watches the media, one always lives in this tension between being a scientist and being a citizen, mm-hmm. that the media really encouraged a kind of vision of a much more sexual, much sexier society than was really going on out there. And so you're caught between those tensions, between, in the absence of data, the media drags you in a certain direction without being anchored very well in terms of what you know.
Getting back to the idea of how often people have sex, here's some statistics. One-third of Americans has sex with a partner at least twice a week, one-third a few times a month, and one-third a few times a year or not at all.
Right.
Any interpretation?
The two effects, I think. One effect is the fact that there are a fairly large number of women over 50 who, in fact, have had no sex at all in the last year. That is, they represent a population of women largely who've been uncoupled or who are in relationships where no sex is going on. Indeed, about 30% of women over age 50 have not had sex in the last year. And it really is that segment of the woman population who are essentially often out of the couple market.
So are you talking about single women in that statistic?
Women who have been divorced, widowed, separated. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the major effects of the older group. Among younger people who are not in stable relationships, you have lower rates. And the third major factor is age. The rates of sexual activity go down inexorably with age. They start high in the 20s and slowly go down, not very precipitately as an average, as you get older. It's the normal wear and tear of life. It's children, how long it takes to get to work, all the other obligations one begins to assume. What tends to happen to most people is that sex gets shunted aside, is sort of put in a different place than it was before marriage.
Now, you have religious and ethnic breakdowns in your study, and you found that a conservative Southerner married for a decade will probably have sex about as often as a West Coast libertarian of the same age. I think you maybe meant liberal, but I'm not sure. Anyways, what's the significance of that?
Well, I think what it is it's how marriage really is the central institution for the management of sexuality in society. That marriages look alike.
No matter what the religion is.
Well, I think so. I think the demands on the relationship, the kind of, everybody has kids. I mean, the main features that are significant, children, jobs, commuting, transcend the differences in dogma.
My guest is John Gagnon, co-author of the new study, Sex in America. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're discussing the new survey of sexual practices in America with co-author John Gagnon. Okay, so in your study you found that really people aren't having sex all that often. But let's get to now, are they, do they want it more or less than they're actually having it?
Well, I think the sex therapists would tell us they do. And I think that people who have views that people ought to be having sex more often for some reason, it's a good thing to have sex more often, would worry about that. But people didn't report very much feeling that they wanted to have sex more often than they were having it. Now, maybe individuals did a bit, but I don't think it was a kind of central motif of the study. Lots of people in the study, even people who are having sex relatively rarely, reported that it was good, that they were satisfied. Some of them said they were thrilled. Many of them reported orgasm. I think that one of the things that happened historically, and I've been trying to reflect on why that would be true, is that we've narrowed down on that the central pleasure of sex must be orgasm. And I think that there's an awful lot of pleasure that goes on in sexual relationships that aren't focused on the orgasm itself or quote, achieving it as if one were working at it. And I think that partially comes out of sort of a male bias toward sexuality, that orgasm is what it's for. But I think there are all kinds of pleasures of reassurance, pleasures of comfort, pleasures of being with somebody else, pleasures that know that you know that you're wanted by somebody else.
Nevertheless, give us the statistics on how often women report actually having orgasms during sex.
Okay, the strong test. Do you have orgasm all the time? 34% of women. Do you have orgasm almost always? Is another 30%. So about 64% of women, I would think, are probably having orgasm somewhere between 80 and 90% of the time, as you convert those verbal reports into some numbers.
And how does that compare with the figures for men?
Oh, the men, about 75% of men have orgasm all the time, indicating a quarter of men aren't having orgasm all the time.
That's surprising, isn't it?
Well, it seems to me that one of our biases has been to ask people about orgasm. And, for instance, if you asked the old Kinsey questions, they were questions not about experience. They were questions about orgasm. And there was an assumption that experience and orgasm were identical, particularly in his first book. It was only when he studied women that he discovered, and gay men, that he discovered people were having a lot of sex, which were experiential, but at which time you didn't have orgasm during it. So a gay man could have oral sex with another man. The other man could ejaculate, but the man himself might not do so. And so the tension between experience and orgasm really became delight really early. So my sense is that probably men don't come all the time. Some men may even fake it. But basically, I think that this is an important sort of a novel kind of statement, really a function of asking a question differently.
Did you ask people about faking it?
No.
And why not?
I don't think we really thought we were going to get 75%. As we thought it was going to be a much smaller phenomenon, and therefore why waste time on another item? I mean, you have an hour and a half, and we wanted to know everything. And
well, here's an interesting statistic. 29% of women said they always had orgasm during sex, but 44% of men said their partners always had orgasm during sex. So there's some discrepancy here between what women are experiencing and what their male partners assume they're experiencing.
There's a whole thread through this study and of the differences between men and women, and some of them less benign than that particular one, which is simply, I misperceive how often these things happen. All the way through the study, there are misperceptions often by men of what's happening with women. For instance, about 20% of the women we interviewed reported to us that they'd been forced to do something sexually during their lifetime. And this is not just rape. We cast a relatively wide net. But many of the events were serious. It was not no one was talking about kissing.
Mm-hmm.
People were talking about serious events, And that 20, and the men, when asked about it, men said, well, they'd forced a woman to do something against her will. About 2% of the men said that. Now, you can think about what all that means, but I think what the central issue is that men's perception of what they do in terms of what the fact that women feel coerced is really very faulty. And that, indeed, what makes that data much more troubling is that over 90% of the men women said they had been forced by were not strangers. These were acquaintances, lovers, husbands. That the great source of coercion for women is not by strangers. And that, I think, is a fundamental measure of the degree to which men and women live in two different sexual worlds.
Now, what are some of the most striking differences you found between religions and the way different religions perceive their sex lives?
Actually, religion isn't a very powerful force, particularly in American society. In terms of those issues, it may be for tiny minorities for whom religion is really directly invested in everyday life. But most people, really the central features are the more secular forces of the society in terms of are they married, do they have kids, all of those kind of mundane things.
What about race? Any striking differences between white people, African Americans, Latinos?
Only who they marry. That is, African Americans marry African Americans, Latinos marry Latinos, whites marry whites, Asians marry Asians. That is, who you choose is drawn from this pool that we talked about. Probably not, in some cases not any more powerful than the education pools that the college-educated marry the college-educated as well. But I think the differences which we see among African Americans, and there are very few. I mean, if you scan endless columns of numbers looking for race effects, you just don't find them. You find that historically, young African Americans have had intercourse earlier in general, but that was true 15 years ago is less true now. It says young whites and young Hispanics age at first intercourse decline. There's some evidence that black men have more partners, but it's not a big difference. I mean, none of these are differences which you'd say, aha, there's a race difference here. You would never, I don't think in any of the data would you have any sense that this was attached to race or ethnicity.
Where you did find a difference, surprisingly to me, is in education and level of education. What did you find?
Well, education, a number of different things tend to appear with education. One is that the educated tend to be more experimental sexually, that is, they're more likely to have oral sex. That educated men often tend to have more sexual partners, which was a surprise to me. I sort of sat and was puzzled about that one for a while and don't have a good explanation. I think the effect of education is through creating more liberal networks of interaction, people who know more about sex, who have access to the media in ways to learn more about sex, who are generally less traditional. Maybe are more interested in mutual pleasure, that is, have the ideology of sensuality in relationships. So there's a whole things that are linked to education. It's not so much time in the classroom as its consequences.
John Gagnon is the co-author of the new book, Sex in America. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, what Americans do in bed, with their partners and by themselves. We continue our discussion about sexual practices and preferences with John Gagnon, one of the authors of a new study about sex in America. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews tonight's season premiere of NYPD Blue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The head of the team disarming Iraq, Rolf Achaeus, reports the system for the long-term monitoring of Iraq's weapons is provisionally operational. Achaeus praised Iraq's cooperation to date, but he said the Iraqis have threatened to cause problems in the future because his report is still not positive enough. The BBC's John Line reports from the UN.
Mr. Achaeus said this report marked a major stage in the work of disarming Iraq. It was a very important new development. But despite the positive nature of the report, he said he believed it had been the trigger to the present crisis. Mr. Achaeus visited Baghdad last week to explain his conclusions to the Iraqi authorities. But he said they were not satisfied with what they'd heard. In particular, the Iraqis wanted the UN to specify a fixed testing period for the new system, after which they could hope for the lifting of sanctions. But that was something Mr. Achaeus was not prepared to offer. Nevertheless, Mr. Achaeus said that before the present crisis erupted, he thought Iraq had been in with a good chance of getting the easing of sanctions, something which has now been thrown into doubt.
John Line reporting. Haiti's legitimate government leaders are busy taking apart the junta government. Ministers loyal to President Jean-Bertrand Aristide are revoking all appointments made by Emile Jonassin, the figurehead president installed by the junta leaders. Meanwhile, gas and diesel fuel are going to Haiti service stations. International companies are shipping fuel to Haiti for the first time since last December. A world trade embargo on Haiti officially ends when Aristide returns on Saturday. The Palestinian group Hamas says it has kidnapped an Israeli soldier and will kill him if Israel doesn't release a number of prisoners it's holding. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
The soldier was last seen Sunday on a road near Ben-Gurion Airport outside of Tel Aviv. Earlier today, Israeli authorities announced that he was missing. Soon afterward, Hamas claimed it was holding the soldier and said he would be killed unless Israel frees several Arab prisoners it is holding, including Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the founder of Hamas, and the leader of the Lebanese group Hezbollah, Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid. Obeid was captured by Israeli commandos in a raid into Lebanon in 1989. Hamas said Friday night is the deadline for the release of the prisoners. Otherwise, it said, Israel would have to negotiate the release of the soldier's body. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Reuters News Service reports the Israeli army has sealed off the Gaza Strip in reaction to this kidnapping claim. It is not clear how this action will affect Palestinian self-rule. On Wall Street, stock prices jumped today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 55.5 points to close at 3,876. Advancing issues led declines by a 3-to-1 margin, heavy trading of 256 million shares. This is NPR. The Nobel Committee has awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics to three men for pioneering a new field called game theory. Two of the recipients are American, and the third is from Germany. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The Nobel was awarded to John Nash of Princeton University and John Harsanyi of the University of California at Berkeley. Harsanyi is a U.S. citizen who was born in Hungary. The third winner was Reinhard Selten of Bonn. Working separately, the three men pioneered a field of study called game theory. It uses the strategies applied in games such as chess and poker to explain economic transactions. Central to the theory is the idea of equilibrium, which attempts to explain how different parties can plot competing economic strategies even when they have optimal information about each other. In awarding the prize today, the Swedish Academy noted that game theory has been used to study everything from the environment to foreign trade. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
PLO leader Yasser Arafat hasn't commented on a Norwegian report he'll share this year's Nobel Peace Prize with Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. Peres has also declined comment. The official announcement is to come on Friday. A Norwegian newspaper reports the selection is being hotly disputed internally, and it could be changed. The paper says the prize committee wanted to honor the two Middle Eastern leaders for negotiating the historic peace accord last year, but the report says one panel member who supported Israel for years opposes Arafat as a choice. Two of the country's largest hospital owners are merging. National Medical Enterprises says it signed a deal to join with American Medical Holdings. The merger is worth about $3.3 billion. National Medical says it will assume more than $1 billion worth of American medical debt. National Medical says the new company expects to generate over $1 billion in pre-tax earnings the first year. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Gagnon, co-author of a new study of Americans' sexual behavior. The study has just been published in academic form and in a more accessible book called Sex in America. The second part of our interview deals with sexual practices, so use your judgment about whether this is suitable listening for you or your family. Let's get into sexual practices and sexual preferences. The most frequently practiced and most preferred form of sex is?
Vaginal intercourse. When we started designing the study, we tried to write a question which said, what is sex, to our respondents? And we were very concerned that everybody would assume that if we asked them a question called, what is sex, they would all think intercourse, that the first thing that would happen in their head. So we said, we had this very complicated prose opening which said, well, If you haven't had intercourse and if it was physical and you were aroused, that's what we mean by sex. And we want us to tell all the people in the last year that you did that with. It turns out after about age 21, it's nearly all that our question didn't help us at all because nearly everybody was having intercourse. We asked everybody in the study what they did the last time they had sex. I mean, what we were looking for was something quite recent. Therefore, they would remember and they wouldn't confuse it with everything else. About 95% of the folks said they had vaginal intercourse the last time. An extraordinary kind of number of people.
What did you find out about oral sex?
I think oral sex retains its tension-producing qualities. People are still ambivalent about it. It's a majority practice, at least among most folks in the society. About somewhere between 75 and 80% of both men and women say that they've had oral sex. Men tend to report more fellatio than women do. As that women, there's a slight, about an 8 or 9% difference between the number of men said, yes, it's been done to me, and the number of women who said, yes, I've done it. And I'd probably expect that. I think that remember, these aren't women and men in the same partnership, so that I suspect that there may be a difference among women who are slightly more liberal and slightly less in sexual relations. Therefore, you would get that kind of difference.
Let's move on to masturbation. You asked many questions about that. And one of the things you really wanted to find out is this. Are people masturbating because they don't have a partner, or are they doing it as a supplement to sex with their partner? And what did you find out?
Well, I think that this is actually quite a striking finding. By the way, this was the most anxiety-producing question in the study.
That's interesting.
It was the first question taken out by the federal government people who were saying when we were the AIDS thing, no questions on masturbation. It seemed to produce a kind of anxiety level, all out of proportion to either its risk for AIDS transmission or anything else. And they said, no, you can't ask that question. And indeed, we've had some difficulty with our own interviewing staff about it. And so we actually asked that question using a self-administered questionnaire.
Seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. As I said it, I could hear the slip coming as I said it. What was interesting about it was that we found what is the reverse of what one would expect to find, at least among adults. Those adults were having the most active partnered sex life. That is, the most partners, most times, were also the people who were masturbating the most often. So it wasn't the wallflower who couldn't get sex from masturbation, who couldn't get partner sex who were masturbating. It was, in fact, people who were actively sexual. And this suggests a different kind of way of thinking about sex. One way to think about sex is sort of like Adam Smith, that if you have a limited sexual economy, And basically, if you don't use it this way, you use it that way. And one is always sort of impelled to use it, but basically there's a limited amount of it. The alternative is really more a Keynesian model, which suggests that people who are active and doing things and energetic and doing thinking about sex a lot, doing sex a lot, are also provoked to be sexual themselves. And in a way, that's much more plausible model if you don't think about sex as a kind of limited expression, and if you have a partner, you've used it all up. But in fact, that sex is really provocational.
We know how you talked about how uncomfortable people are talking about masturbation. And I think for people who are in a couple, part of that discomfort comes from this fear that there's maybe, is this, if you masturbate, is that a sign that there's something inadequate about the couple relationship? Did you ask people about that?
No, we didn't ask them about that. But I think that's a correct presumption. I think that describes what people sort of say. Well, it also expresses some kinds of ownership about sex.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the sex, it belongs to me. When we got married, I bought all of your sexual life, including your masturbation. And so all orgasms ought to be directed at me. Otherwise, there's something wrong with me. If your masturbation is a commentary on how much I satisfy you.
My guest is John Gagnon, the author of a new study on sex in America. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Gagnon, co-author of the new book, Sex in America. Let's move on to homosexuality. One of the things you wanted to find out is how many Americans identify as homosexual or bisexual. Your figures were really surprisingly small. You found that 2.8% of men and 1.4% of women identify as gay or bisexual. That's a contradiction to the Kinsey study, which found a much higher percentage. How do you explain your finding?
Well, I think that what's happened was that the Kinsey data itself was all heavily inflated.
Mm-hmm.
I said the very process by which people were recruited tended to oversample or overgather people who had sex with other men who had sex with men. But I think what happened was that of the Kinsey figures, and recall what Kinsey said, what the 10% number meant. It was a number which said that for 3 years of their life, men between 15 and some older age had sex only with other men. Now, that's 3 years. It could be one time a year for 3 years as long as they had no sex with women. So it could be entirely casual behavior. And I think the evidence is, when I reanalyze the Kinsey figures themselves, that the number we came up with, once again with a colleague of mine, was about 3% of men over 20 and about 3% over men who were bisexual. So we had a figure of 6% even from a biased sample. Now, that data never got very much publicity, but it was actually published 20 years ago. So I think now these numbers are probably slightly lower. I think people, in fact, everybody did not tell us the truth. But if we doubled the figure, it would only be 5%. I think we're in the right part of the ballpark. I think that's what I would say about it.
Significantly fewer number of women identify as gay or bisexual as compared to men. Are we able to have an explanation for that?
What's interesting about that is I think that also a larger proportion of women express desire than men did.
Unacted on desire.
And I think that that there is the mechanism which facilitates women to be asexual is very powerful in this society. And at the same time, the mechanism which can recruit women to these desires are also very weak. So that, in a sense, women get lost in both ways. Women who might be deeply satisfied by a same-gender sexual commitment, in fact, never enter into this world.
How do you think your statistics will be used, since homosexuality has become such a kind of political and social controversy in America, and your figures show that there are fewer people who identify as gay or bisexual than a lot of other people claim. How do you think your figures will be used?
Well, I think they'll probably, that if I say to you that 4% of the population of the United States between 18 and 59 are gay, I'm talking about 3 million people. I'm talking about more people than there are Jews in the United States. And I think the issue of homosexuality is not an issue of numbers. It's an issue of civil liberties. And I think you have to sort of not, that's the issue. And I think that's the way it has to be contained and understood. And I think you have to get out of the whole set of questions about, is it biological, is it social? None of those things have ever protected anybody against people who want to persecute you. What protects you is political action. And I think, and the appeal to rights which people have. And I think that this is a civil liberties issue, not a numbers issue.
Let me move on to AIDS, which you studied in that was actually one of the main reasons why you did the study in the first place. And you report something that really surprises me. Your finding is that you expect that AIDS is going to basically stay within certain populations and probably not significantly break into populations other than gay men, IV drug users, and people who are very poor and uneducated. Do I have that right?
I think it's the people who are poor and uneducated who are in connection with IV drug users.
Mm-hmm.
That the cores of the epidemic were started in this society among men who had sex with men, in that kind of abstract term, most of whom were gay-identified, and it occurred among intravenous drug users and their sexual partners. There are two points to be made. One is, if you actually examine the AIDS statistics, that is, people who are moving from HIV positive to AIDS, what we see is nearly all the new cases are coming exactly in those same social groups they were coming from 10 years ago. So that's one side of the debate. But on the sexual side, one needs to say, think of the logic of all of this. That is, people choose partners who are very much like themselves. So there are islands of interaction. If the epidemic is in African-American communities and in Latin Puerto Rican communities in New York, how do they get out? To whom do these partners then go? The second thing is, what about numbers of partners? If people don't have very many partners, it's very unlikely they're going to have bridges to other groups. If people don't have sex very often, it means that the rates of sex are going to be low. And at the end, if you ask people, did you have anal intercourse the last time you had sex, it represents 1% of the population who said they had anal intercourse, which is the most risky of all the sexual behaviors. It doesn't mean that transmission is zero. It simply means that it's the concept of relative risk, that it depends on who you're connected with. And finally, what is the likelihood of transmission in each act? The virus is very difficult to transmit. We're not arguing by this that people should be careless. Other sexually transmitted diseases are very easy to transmit. People can get pregnant and have pregnancies they don't want. And there's a whole bunch of untoward side effects which affect people's sexual lives. Our argument is that even while these are true and they're important, but you don't want to ride these on AIDS. Why don't you? You don't want to because what happens is you begin spending your money in the wrong places. In the state of California, 80% of all the people who have AIDS are gay men. 8% of the state's money for prevention is spent among gay men. You have to spend the money where the epidemic is, both for the safety of those people who are in greatest danger.
Has this conclusion been very controversial?
I think that lots of people aren't going to be very happy with it. I think that the positions of sort of universal prevention, you know, spend an equal amount of money everywhere, was appropriate in the earliest stages of the epidemic. I think that given the hostility of the Reagan-Bush administration to AIDS, to AIDS, to people who had AIDS, their hostility to spending money, and the fact that we didn't know how far the epidemic was going to spread in those early days, up until, say, 85, 86, 87. It was not clear how far, and therefore that was a reasonable position. But what we need to do is not get locked into that position because we had it earlier.
It's probably very interesting for you to watch what the media and what the public has most picked up on from your study. So I'd really like your sense of what you think of what everyone else has found to be the most interesting and the most controversial parts of your research.
It's puzzling. I think that Kinsey was a study which occurred against a backdrop of a society that thought it wasn't sexual at all. And therefore, there was this dramatic explosion of anger and rage by one group of people and recognition by another. No matter how bad the study was, that was the symbolic event. This study appears against a backdrop of a society which is not quite rabidly sexual, but it's hard to miss it. And I think the fact that we are now saying that we are not as sexual as we are is what has struck everybody. It's exactly the reversal of the original one. And most of the complaint about Kinsey was, all of those people lied to you, they told you too much. And all the people who say it to me is, all those people lied to you, they didn't tell you anything. But I think both of those sentences are lodged historically as commentaries about how a survey stands against a backdrop and what it means to a society.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the sex study that you co-conducted. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Gagnon is co-author of Sex in America and of a more academic publication based on the same survey called The Social Organization of Sexuality. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from Iraq?
Well, we'll hear today the latest news on the Iraq-Kuwait crisis and the movement of Iraqi troops. Also, we'll be talking with reporter Mary Kay Magstad, who is in Kuwait City, about what the reaction there has been to this latest episode of military pressure from the north. And we'll be talking with Hugh Pope, a British journalist who's based in Istanbul, about the Kurds, one of the Iraqi minorities whom the United States and other UN powers want Iraq to stop persecuting. We'll hear what's actually been going on in northern Iraq, where the Kurds live, since the Gulf War.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight marks the return of NYPD Blue on ABC and the premiere of a Fox telemovie called Roseanne, an Unauthorized Biography. Critic David Bianculli reviews them both.
NYPD Blue had the biggest advance buzz of all the new series last year because of all the talk about its nudity and adult language. This year, it's had the biggest buzz of all the returning series because of David Caruso's decision to leave the show to pursue a movie career. But the buzz doesn't count. Only the show does. And that's why NYPD Blue survived last year. The flashes of nudity were a gimmick, sometimes even a distraction. But the actors and characters and scripts were wonderful and made NYPD Blue a lot of fun to watch. It'll survive this year, too, for the same reason. I've already given David Caruso this year's McLean Stevenson Memorial I'm Gonna Quit This Show and Become a Big Star Award because he's making a big mistake. Most people in Hollywood make that mistake of looking up to movies and down on television. But if Caruso wants to be challenged by his scripts and to develop a character to the fullest possible extent, there's no way he's going to get 22 hours worth of similar material each year as a film actor. But since he wants out, the producers will find a way. And they may already be laying the groundwork in tonight's show, which has Caruso's John Kelly taking the stand in the Janis Lacalce murder case. As in any high-profile double homicide, once Kelly testifies, the tabloids start coming after him.
Norman, what makes you think if I were to talk to somebody that it would be you?
You think $100,000 might change your attitude? Because that's what I've been trying to call you about.
Not interested.
My people will give you $100,000 for an exclusive interview when you're done at the trial.
Not interested.
You not interested in $100,000 when someone putting Prozac in your granola?
No more messages, no more calls. Got it?
Yeah, it's me, Kelly. What's coming out of that courtroom? You should start looking at new sources of income.
Meanwhile, NYPD Blue continues to showcase co-star Dennis Franz, whose alcoholic Andy Sipowicz is the true soul of this show. His on-again, off-again courtship with Sylvia, played by Sharon Lawrence, is off again, but maybe not for long. I say maybe because his character, like this show, doesn't like to rush things.
I hope to have something to say to you soon on a personal matter.
Why don't you just say it?
At this point, I gotta wait.
All right.
I hope it'll be very soon. Just wanted you to know.
The bottom line is that NYPD Blue is alive and well. Meanwhile, over on Fox, Roseanne, an unauthorized biography, is dead and sick. Bad doesn't begin to describe it. Repugnant, festering, those begin to describe it. The easiest way to prove just how bad this telemovie is, and how awful Denny Dillon of Dream On is in the title role, is to play a scene with her as Roseanne. Any scene will do. When she's supposed to be funny, it's sad. And when she's supposed to be sad, it's funny. Here's an example of the supposedly dramatic stuff. If you're driving right now, hold on to the wheel.
And who the hell was I? Somebody's wife. Somebody's mother. Somebody's daughter. The money, the power, being famous. That was how I was gonna deal with all the crap. I would tell myself, I'll deal with it when I made it as a stand-up. I'll deal with it when I got my own show. But there was always something else. The answer was never there. Where is it?
I rest my case. The scary thing is, I can't even say with conviction that Roseanne, an unauthorized biography, should end up as the worst telemovie of the season. Another Roseanne bio is coming up in 2 weeks on NBC, and Fox has quickie bios of Mia Farrow and O.J. Simpson on tap. Calling tonight's Roseanne clunker the season's worst, I'm afraid, might be unduly optimistic.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News and the author of Teleliteracy. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tim O'Brien is one of our best writers about the Vietnam War. His new novel, A Lake in the Woods, is about a politician who has covered up his participation in the My Lai Massacre. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with O'Brien about fighting the war and writing about the war. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.